This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and we are coming to you all this week from WLRN in Miami, Florida. Here in the Sunshine State, we have beautiful beaches, theme parks, amazing food, vibrant music, and all of those wonderful things. But the day-to-day reality for young people in the state, especially young Black Floridians, is very different. Many say they're worried about gun violence.
I always thought about gun violence. I think it was one of my eighth grade year, I was 13. My dad got shot multiple times just sitting outside. So that's when I started thinking more about guns and how it affected us in the community. So I think I was 13.
Same, 12 or 13, because in NAACP, we just didn't talk about what we going to do to raise money to go to national convention. We talked about the gun violence. We talked about the person who actually got shot the other day. We just talked about the relevant topic. So 12 or 13, when I officially joined the NAACP, is when I actually started focusing on guns.
Those were two students from Miami Norland Senior High School. Jeremiah Johnson is a sophomore and Aaliyah Blackman is a junior. The school is in the Miami Gardens neighborhood of South Florida, which has one of the highest rates of violent crime nationwide. And the children who live there feel that every day.
I'm more afraid of walking down my street than I am going to school with a gun. It's less likely to get shot in a school in my city than it is going outside of the community, like going to the store or something like that.
Miami Gardens is about 30 minutes south of Parkland, Florida, where a gunman killed 17 people at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School earlier this year. But while Parkland has much lower rates of violent crime, Aaliyah says the tragedy brought long overdue attention to a crisis that has plagued her neighborhood for years. And unlike the students at Parkland, for Aaliyah and many of her classmates, school is the safe space.
I feel like if it wasn't for the Parkland shooting, there would never have been a talk about gun violence, like ever. But there's kids out here in the Black and brown community who have been thinking about gun violence for the longest. We've been talking about it for years and years and years. And all of a sudden, when a middle-class area gets shot up one time by one of their own students, now it's a problem. Now we have to talk about it. It is sad that a few students died, but then we have people dying every day in our face, our own classmates. We can't go outside past a certain time. You can't do this, you can't do that, because you're scared of dying from a gun or something like that. It kind of upsets me because it's like, you guys are not really thinking about the big picture. You guys are literally talking about one instance that happened one time. I'm pretty sure Parkland will never have another shooting. I can tell you that in my community, there will be another shooting sometime soon.
What are you guys doing, if anything, to engage with preventing gun violence in your communities? Like, is that a priority for you? Are you trying to get involved in doing that? And how can you do it with the lack of attention?
Well, try going out to events such as town hall meetings. You try to get the publicity there. You try to speak there as you can so that they hear your voice. And you try doing that at other meetings so that you keep going on and going on, so your voice is heard and you're speaking for the rest of your generation as of right now.
I basically, what Jeremiah says, communication. It's basically all communication. If one person knows about the town hall meeting, maybe they'll bring five more friends, or they bring three more. And the more people that come, the more people know about gun violence, how it's affecting our communities. So the more you learn, the more you educate, the better. I feel like we'll be better as a generation.
You all feel, to me, like a generation that is becoming increasingly politically engaged. I mean, you have a button on your shirt that says Rock the Vote. I remember when that came out a long time ago, but I feel like there's a new energy in young people today and getting engaged, particularly young people of color. What do your parents think about where you guys are politically today?
Well, my mom is really excited because I'm staying out of trouble. The organizations that I'm in, Social Leadership Collective and Dream Defenders, they keep me out of trouble. They educate me to tell me, don't be a statistic. The one thing you don't want to be is a statistic. So they tell me about how this will affect me in the future. How did you get this way? Why does it affect your friends? It's just a bunch of stuff that comes together. And my mom seeing me out trying to help other people and stop them from doing bad things, or educating them, giving them a microphone, or giving them some type of way, an outlet, it makes her happy to see that I'm doing something positive in my life.
Same thing. I talked to my dad and my mom about it. My dad looks at me, he sees that I'm more into this stuff. Like, I do so much for my communities because I'm in the NAACP as well, youth council. Speaking to politics with other people, it actually helps me to engage myself with others, and it keeps me away from all this harm and danger around this world. It's trying, not doing no stealing, no killing, not even putting a gun in my hand, even though I've seen it many times.
So you've seen guns many times, yes, personally.
Ma'am. Personally,
tell me about that.
I seen, for example, like kids brung BB guns. They brung not. They didn't bring regular guns. I seen regular guns outside in the communities in like a sewer. I looked downward and all I see is a. I think it was a handgun. I forgot. I think it was a 45, and I also seen a knife with it. And I was like, wow, that's what they hid over here. Then I seen it inside around a big grass area around where I live, and I was like, okay, this is pretty. It's pretty real. So that's when I felt like the talk needed to be even. And that's when I was 8. But then when I got older, I said the talk needed to be then instead of just now. So
you were 8 and you were seeing guns in the street.
8, 9, and it kept getting older.
What does that do? Did that have an impact on you?
And yes. Well, when seeing the guns, it actually made me not afraid of it, but it made me just distant from it. So I wouldn't put it in my hands, because as people, when they have a gun, they feel as if they got even more power with it. They feel like they're more in control with that weapon. So when I looked at it, I was like, I never want to put a gun in my hand.
I used to live in Liberty City, but Liberty is not a great place to grow up in. So my parents moved out and moved me to Miami Gardens. But when I moved to Miami Gardens, as I got older, I started to realize guns, we have like little toy guns. Everyone has like little toy guns. But my brother once went outside with one that was black. My parents told him he couldn't go outside because it looked too real.
What were they worried about would happen?
It would be mistaken as a real gun. If a police come down my block and think this little boy's playing with a gun, he might get gunned down at a young age. They might call DCF because they think we have guns in our house, or something worse.
So the threat of gun violence, I want to be clear, in your communities is not just from community members. You're also concerned about police gun violence, right?
Yes.
Where I used to live is like down, my dad lives here, my mom used to live here, it was down the street from each other, so we could be very close, even though they're divorced. So my mom moved, we moved, and I lived with my dad, and so that's when police was being in talks or being placed in the area. And so while this happened, a few weeks later, my neighbor's son got shot in the head, right, like the police car, they got the car right here, her house is right there, and so he got shot in the head. And so that's when I was like, it's ridiculous. Not even a police, they're here to protect. And some, not all cops are bad cops, in my opinion. It's, you got some of the best, you got great, and then you got some that just got something wrong with them. But just bringing in police in general in our area would not bring any peace, not any justice.
I feel like police is an iffy situation. Some people think, oh yes, add more police, that will completely solve the problem. No, it will not. Let's think of in school. A lot of children, we playfully say this, but some of us be really serious when we say it. School is like a prison. I don't feel like we should be thinking at age 14, 13, 17 that school is a prison. You have us locked up in these gates. You have security guards. Security guards are there to secure the premises. That's what they do. You have a couple school police around to, just in case anything else pop off, they're there. Adding more police will make us feel like we're literally in jail. Why do you want more black and brown people feeling like they're in jail already? You should put them in an environment that's more loving and secure. Like, we already have police. We have a good amount of police, I personally feel. I feel like those police should be more attentive, like be more focused on what they're doing. Because if you add more police to our communities, a lot of police, not all police are the same. So they have different views of different things. So if you have a couple of police that are like actually doing their job, trying to make sure everything is safe and sound when it comes to guns, then you have those that just want to lock up people for the most pettiest thing. Those people over there, they're loitering, they got to go. The people over there, jaywalking, they got to go. Some police will start going to picking people up for petty crimes instead of really thinking about the big picture. So you have a bunch of kids locked up again for petty stuff.
So what is the solution? What do you guys see as the solution?
I think if it's one solution, we got to start at the younger age group. Starting with the younger age group, you speaking to them about guns, because a lot of children actually are now focused towards guns, in my opinion. Like, if you go into Walmart, you could see a replica. It's not, let me say a replica. It's like it looks just like a gun. I was like, wow, I see all of this on the shelves. I see now, that's when I was like, now I see where the kids are understanding and where they're looking towards, because you see it all on the shelves for as toys. When they get older, they look at something getting a real gun. That's why many rappers got it in their videos. And so by we talking to children and even getting children to release, instead of releasing their anger using a gun, we try to get a space closed, like a space like this, so where they could release their anger in a different way, such as throwing glass or making something out of that glass into something beautiful. Some solutions like that could help children change. And then it'll and try to work with adults towards that, so that it could help them feel, okay, we bringing peace towards each other. We just leave it right there. Into that beautiful piece.
I completely agree with Jeremiah. I feel like we need more community centers. I feel like once you get them at a young age, that's when, because you know, children are more moldable. So you can, like, whatever they're used to seeing, that's what they're gonna click on. So if you have little kids, they have a lot of little children. My little cousin, he was like 6, telling me he wanna play Call of Duty. And I was like, Call of Duty number 1 is rated like 18. Why are you playing? And I asked him, I was like, why do you want to play? He's like, I want to be in the army. I said, why you want to be in the army? Because I want to kill people. And I was like, why do you have in your mind to kill people? Why? There's other little boys that think the same way just like him. You have these guns, like, all over the place. You have the little fake guns everywhere. You see little kids, pashoon, like, just going around trying to, like, act like they're killing people. That's not okay. Why do we have such a image of guns? I don't understand. So I feel like we should talk to them about guns. We need to tell them how it really works, show them real statistics, show them videos, tell them stories so they'll know this is not to play with. Guns is for protection, not for playing with.
Do you see, or I don't know if you guys already have, like, formed any type of solidarity with victims of school shootings, if there's any common ground there to be able to do that?
I know for Soul Sisters, we have restorative justice circles, which is a way where everyone comes in a circle to talk about the problem, or we just come together and just cry it out, or whatever you need. It's organizations out here that will give you a space to cry it out or talk it out or have support. That's what we're here for, to support you guys. So if we see, like, there's a big incident, we come together and we talk about it as a community.
Aaliyah Blackman is a junior and Jeremiah Johnson is a sophomore. They both attend Miami Norland Senior High.
Hello, yes, can I go in with you, please?
No, sir, you cannot go in with me.
Oh.
You cannot be here to private property.
And let me introduce myself. I'm Senator Jeff Merkley from Congress. And my team contacted this facility and asked for permission for me to come and see what is going on inside with these children.
Well, we don't have any permission on that, so I'm going to have to please ask you to step away, sir.
Over the weekend, Jeff Merkley, Democratic senator from Oregon, visited Southwest Key Casa Padre, a migrant children's shelter in Brownsville, Texas.
Police just got here.
Okay. Well, that's okay. I'll talk to him.
A few minutes after the senator arrived, officials from the center called the police and requested that he leave.
I haven't asked to leave the property, but I'm guessing that's about what's to happen.
Yeah, sir, I think that's what they're going towards. What was your name again, sir? I'm sorry, Senator?
Senator Jeff Merkley.
Jeff?
U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley.
Senator Merkley's visit was prompted by the new zero-tolerance policy that Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced last month. The policy targets migrants who are caught crossing the U.S.-Mexico border or requesting asylum, and those traveling with children risk being separated from them. Just today, the United Nations Human Rights Office called the policy arbitrary and unlawful and, quote, a serious violation of the rights of children. To understand why Senator Merkley was denied access, we reached out to the Health and Human Services Office of Refugee Resettlement. They're the ones who contracted the nonprofit organization Southwest Key to run the Casa Padre facility. In response, they told us, quote, the Department of Health and Human Services takes the legal mandate to care for these children seriously. No one who arrives unannounced at one of our shelters demanding access to the children in our care will be permitted, even those claiming to be U.S. senators. For more on what happened at the migrant children's shelter in Brownsville, Senator Merkley joins me now. Senator, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
I watched the video and it was pretty intense. What was your goal in visiting this facility?
Well, my hope was to get a tour of the facility. Reportedly, there are 1,000 children locked up inside, many of whom may be unaccompanied minors who arrived in the U.S., but many whom also arrived with their families but have been forcibly separated from their parents as their parents await asylum hearings. This new policy is one we have never seen, and that is the administration saying that when people have gone through horrific circumstances abroad and apply for asylum in the U.S., we're going to double down on cruelty to the children in order to dissuade them from actually coming to seek asylum. And that's just reprehensible, unacceptable, un-American, immoral, and it needs to end.
Now, when you arrived, you mentioned that you had called a week prior and you were following up by in person. I just read in a comment provided to us by HHS that your visit was unannounced.
Well, there were, so HHS, and there's confusion on this. There are three facilities that I applied to see, one through the Catholic Church, which they gave permission for, one for the Department of Homeland Security, which they gave permission for. That's a detention center, and or a processing center. That's quite a site in itself. And then this Walmart where 1,000 children are locked up. HHS, when we contacted them, did not give me permission. However, I felt I'm in the area. I might as well go knock on the door and say, look, I'm a U.S. senator. Nothing should be hidden from policymakers. I want to see what's going on here. Can you give me a little tour? And I thought there was a 50-50 chance they'd go ahead and give me a tour, but as it turned out, that was not the case.
What you were able to see, can you describe that for our listeners who may not have seen the video?
Certainly. And let me share a little bit with you also about the other facility, this processing center. You go in and you see a series of cages that look like large dog kennels, with people jammed into them with space blankets. They look exhausted. They look terrified. There's a number of folks who are emotionally upset. A number of folks in these dog kennel-type cages, large cages, holding babies. And then an adjacent room is a huge warehouse. And in this huge warehouse are very large cages in which the children have been separated from the parents. So one of those very large cages held, must have been around 50 young boys. And the tallest was not much taller than my desk. So I would guess 4 or 5 years old. And then they were, because they were in line by height, that went up through, I gather, 16 or 17 years old. To realize that these children have just recently been at that facility, separated from their parents, is something that should be of concern for everyone. But at that moment, after they are separated, they are transferred from DHS authority, Department of Homeland Security, to the Department of Health and Human Services, which runs these large detention centers. These detention centers, the activities there are being hidden from the American public.
Now, the White House has responded to your attempted visit, and Deputy Press Secretary Hogan Gidley actually said, quote, you were irresponsibly spreading blatant lies. What's your response to that?
Well, this is on the Department of Homeland Security side, not the Health and Human Services side, where I was visiting the Walmart where 1,000 children reportedly are incarcerated. But we have no idea what he's talking about. I mean, quite frankly, what I'm describing to you is what I saw. We're not blaming the people who work there. And I say we, those are all of us who are here who are very concerned about this. It's the administration that's accountable. The administration's tactic is try to change the topic and pretend that you're blaming someone else. I'm blaming the President of the United States. I'm blaming the Attorney General. I'm blaming the head of Homeland Security for what is happening at that facility.
Now, of course, we know that under the Obama administration, there were also thousands of migrant children housed in shelters. I understand that these are separate issues, but I guess the question is, where was everybody then, right? Why wasn't there so much attention paid to these children and the conditions that they were living under the Obama administration?
Well, I can't speak to the details of that, but I think you're referring to the case of unaccompanied minors. So these the children in that case were not being separated from their parents. There was not a strategy of inflicting harm on children. There was a strategy of caring for children until they got to trial. The system did get overloaded, and the Bama team worked very hard to expand the capability of the system to address that when there was a significant wave of unaccompanied minors. But that is not the issue I'm raising here. The issue I'm raising here is that the administration is deliberately inflicting trauma on children to influence their parents, and that is new and that is wrong.
Senator Jeff Merkley is a Democratic senator from Oregon. To read the full response from the Department of Health and Human Services, you can visit thetakeaway.org. Senator, thanks for being with us.
You're very welcome. Pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Hey folks, Alex Boti here, producer with The Takeaway. And while Tanzina has been down in Miami covering climate change for us, we've been hearing from you on what's happening in your area.
Hi, my name is Margaret. I live in Hollywood, Florida. We're about a mile or so from the ocean, and during certain times of the year, we have really terrible street flooding on sunny days, but at high tide. And every year that we've been here, it's gotten worse and worse.
This is Lonnie Bravo. We live in Brevard County, Florida, which is the east coast of Central Florida. Our winters are not as cold or as long as they were just 10 years ago. This has led to warmer water in our Indian River Lagoon. We are seeing more and more large algae blooms in the lagoon, leading to more frequent fish kills. Our lagoon is dying.
This is Dakota from Newport Richey, Florida. I live a little north of Tampa. It's getting hotter and wetter every year. The bugs won't hibernate because it's not getting cold enough. I also feel like it's sunnier. It's only going to get worse.
Hi, my name is Ed Jimenez. I live on a barrier island east of the Intercoastal in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And climate change is alive and well here. My neighborhood, on a regular basis, especially on a king tide, has the beach, road, sidewalk all washed away. It's happening here.
Thanks so much for getting back to us on this. And you can always call us at 8778-MYTAKE or talk to us on Facebook, and we will get back to you. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about gentrification and climate change, how they affect each other, and what they mean for people's lives. Tanzina's down in Miami all week, so make sure to get your voice heard. Thanks. Now back to the show.
In 1986, Donna Hilton was sentenced to 25 years to life for kidnapping and second-degree murder. Inside Bedford Hills Correctional Facility, she was inmate number 86G0206. Hilton was released in 2012, and outside of the maximum security prison, she was lost.
I spent almost 3 decades, so it's a lot. It's overwhelming. You know, there's no preparation for someone like me who spent overwhelming majority of their life in prison, in an abnormal environment where you don't really have in what society the world has.
The victim of abuse by her mother and later her adoptive parents, Hilton says she never learned the tools for how to navigate the outside world. But now she's dedicating her life to fighting for justice for other women like her, women who are trying to overcome the link between trauma and incarceration. According to a 2016 study from the Vera Institute of Justice, 86% of women in prison had experienced sexual violence before being incarcerated. Her story is the subject of a new memoir, A Little Piece of Light, a memoir of hope, prison, and life unbound.
It says a lot when we don't value women. And you can see it in the way we're treated. 72% of women that are incarcerated are mothers. And if you're a woman, you don't even really have visits. The family's ripped apart. And whatever's left of it, they don't really go see the mother. But you can go to any male facility and it's packed. I promise you, any day. All right? And why is that? I met so many women and girls just in Bedford who actually didn't physically commit a crime, number one, or they didn't physically commit because they wanted to. They were forced to. But we never look at the individual We never look at the individual's story. We never see the person as a human being.
We being the justice, the criminal justice system, or...
And people. Because we're fed a narrative, right? I walk down the street, you would never know I spent 27 years in prison for kidnapping and murder. You would just never know. So who are we really talking about? It brings about a fear that is false. We create these narratives to make people afraid, to make people react, to make people do what we want to do. And they're wrong.
I'll just give you one data point. We found that in 2016, 86% of women who were in prison had experienced some type of sexual violence before being incarcerated.
86 that we know about. My experience is that, and I know women right now who have not told, because it's a place some people just can't revisit.
What role do you think trauma played in your life?
The trauma played, because I was my natural mother, because I come from Jamaica, the island of Jamaica. I know that my mother, my natural mother, had a mental disease, you know, mental health issue, and she was very abusive. But she would fluctuate between the two, like loving a mother. But that's my mom, right? I was my mother, the only mother I knew I had. By the time they brought me to this country, and I didn't know I was never going back home, I just thought I was just going to Disneyland and I would be fine. I didn't get it as a kid. So that trauma from my mother's abuse, then being ripped away from my mother, then being brought to this country to a couple who then started abusing me, because by the time I turned nine and a half, I started being taken into a closet and being raped, sodomized, all kinds of things. And so I was a child. So immediately I was disassociating. I was trying to, you know, my body went into survival mode. My mind as a child can't fight back. You don't know how to fight back because trauma paralyzes you. And as a child, oftentimes you take all that stuff in. You know what's wrong. You know what's bad, but you start blaming yourself. And so in blaming yourself, you lose yourself more and more and more and more and more. And it kept happening. There's one thing I've learned quickly. Predators know prey. And I was prey from childhood.
Was there a moment that you became very aware that you were connecting trauma with your past criminal history? Or do you separate those things?
So let me say, I don't have a criminal history. I'm not a criminal. I have to be clear on that. The crime that I was forced to be in was that was it. And I would not have been involved in that crime if I didn't have a gun pulled on me and I was told what to do. My life was threatened. I was raped. And I was a victim in the crime. So I have to be clear in saying that. But even to get to that place where I became like I was forced into a situation, that's because I couldn't understand, or I didn't see. I didn't have the guidance. I was a kid still. Only thing that I knew was that I was focused on was when I go home, am I going to be hurt again?
You also talk about other women you've met while you were incarcerated. What are the types of stories that you've heard from the women that you've met that tell you that there's a link between trauma and criminality? I mean, in this case, right? There is a link in between those things, or you don't think so?
Yes, I do believe on the greater, yeah. There is always a before. Poverty is violence and it's trauma. So we don't want to look and understand that certain communities are so impoverished and conditioned to believe that they're not worthy to do anything else but exactly deal with what they have, that they go on to do things that can be labeled as criminal, right? And so it doesn't mean that it's okay, that it's right, but we have to understand why it happens. And so, again, to your point, trauma can lead to criminal acts, yes, but why? And a lot, oftentimes now what we see, if not the vast majority, it's based because mental health. The reason is because of mental health. Prisons and jails have become the response to mental health. We are criminalizing behaviors that are out of people's control.
And well, that's what I was going to ask you too, is like when you were incarcerated, did you receive any any sort of help to, to probe these issues a little deeper, or any of the women that you were working with?
It's kind of contradictory, right? When I say I was fortunate enough to have been put in prison at a time where the warden at that time understood that the women in her prison have been through some stuff. And so she allowed for us to create programs that we knew we needed to help ourselves. So we've developed the family violence program to address each and every area of abuse in a woman, in a girl's life. And it went from ritual abuse, sexual abuse for as a child, child sexual abuse, adult sexual abuse, family. I mean, they're different components, but they're all trauma, right? They're all violence.
I want you to tell us about, because I think those are all critical points, but I want you to tell us a little bit about what you do, the organization that you have, From Life to Life.
Yeah. So From Life to Life, though, the name came, I was thinking about a name to define basically what I'm doing. And I was like, well, I went from doing life to living life because I was imprisoned before I went to prison. And I recognize quickly that my journey is a journey of so many other women. And I hope that my story, I hope that my walk maybe can instigate in them, can show them, hey, you're valuable, you're worthy, you're beautiful, you're amazing, you're a lot of beautiful things.
Donna Hilton is a criminal justice reform advocate and senior justice fellow at the nonprofit organization CATAL. Her new memoir called A Little Piece of Light is out today.
Thanks for joining us on our second broadcast from WLRN in Miami. We'll be back tomorrow with the story of climate change and gentrification. And as always, we want to hear from you. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.